This is VOA News. I'm Scott Walterman. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Thursday that the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework has made substantial progress.
We signed the first-of-its-kind supply chain agreement to help identify supply chain bottlenecks before they become the kind of disruptions we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Biden also announced the group is launching a critical minerals dialogue with the objective of strengthening supply chains and promoting the creation of clean energy jobs. The UN's top court is expected to rule on Friday on a long-running clash between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, which Baku seized in September. Armenia has dragged Azerbaijan before the International Court of Justice, hoping judges will force Baku to stop displacing ethnic Armenians from the territory and facilitate the return of anyone who wishes to come home. In Gaza, the Israeli military said it found the body of one of the hostages abducted by Hamas, a 65-year-old woman, a cancer patient, whose husband was killed in the October 7th Hamas attack. Her body, they say, was found in a building adjacent to Shifa Hospital, where the IDF said it also found assault rifles and rocket-propelled grenades. Hamas is a U.S.-designated terrorist group. EU Council President Charles Michel met with European leaders in Zagreb, talking about the bloc's enlargement.
We know that the enlargement, the prospect of the enlargement is very important because we know that the EU will be safer and more prosperous with those countries.
This is VOA News. More pandas may be coming to the United States from China. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Last week, three giant pandas left the National Zoo here in Washington.
This is a hard morning.
It was rough on zoo director Brandy Smith, and Chinese President Xi Jinping says he knows it was hard for many Americans to say goodbye, calling pandas envoys of friendship between the two nations. In a speech after yesterday's summit with President Biden, Xi appeared to suggest China will send more pandas, most likely to San Diego. There are now just four pandas left in the U.S. in Atlanta. Sagar Magani, Washington.
It's Red Cup Day at Starbucks. That means in addition to getting a free reusable holiday cup, it has now become tradition for thousands of Starbucks workers to walk off the job. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has more.
Just like they did on last year's Red Cup Day.
Union Busters got too far.
Give us a behind the bar.
Thousands of workers at some 200 Starbucks locations are planning to walk off the job to demand that more stores be unionized and more staffers are scheduled on busy days like Red Cup Day. A barista in Oklahoma City, Neha Kremen, says workers are already overwhelmed and says understaffing hurts the workers and also creates an unpleasant experience for customers. Starbucks is downplaying any impact from the walkouts, which started Wednesday. More than 360 of its approximately 10,000 stores are unionized. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The House Ethics Committee issued a scathing report on Thursday, saying it has amassed overwhelming evidence of lawbreaking by Republican Representative George Santos of New York, and that they have sent that information to the Justice Department, concluding flatly that he cannot be trusted after a months-long investigation into his conduct. A Russian court has convicted an artist and musician for replacing supermarket price tags with anti-war slogans, sentencing her to 7 years in prison. 33-year-old Sasha Skochilikenko has been held since April 2022 on charges of spreading false information about the military. She was arrested a month after Russia adopted a law effectively criminalizing any public expression about the war in Ukraine that deviates from the Kremlin's official line. Check out our website, voanews.com. I'm Scott Walterman, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Friday, November 17, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Major humanitarian organizations will not participate in creating unilateral safe zones in Gaza.
There was a statement that UNRWA, the agency where I work, has endorsed, and we will not support such proposals.
U.S. President Joe Biden has come under increasing pressure to rein in Israel's military campaign. 30 people are killed in intercommunal fighting in Sudan's Darfur region. Malawi's president suspends foreign trips due to a currency devaluation.
In making those painful adjustments, I myself have to lead by example. This is why, effective immediately, all of my international trips between now and the end of the fiscal year are canceled.
And the mayor of Sierra Leone's capital has been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential climate defenders for 2023. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under increasing pressure to rein in Israel's military campaign against Hamas, with concern mounting about the high number of Palestinian civilians killed. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane reports from the State Department.
The Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest, has become a focal point of the Israel-Hamas war. The Hamas-run Ministry of Health released video, it says, shows patients being moved inside smoke-filled corridors as Israeli forces raid the large hospital compound one building at a time. The Israeli army released video that it says shows Hamas weapons and military equipment it found in the hospital. Hamas denies it is using the medical center for military purposes. President Joe Biden said that the first war crime committed by Hamas was stationing its weapons and fighters in, under, and around hospitals.
Israel did not go in with a large number of troops, did not raid, did not rush everything down. They've gone in, and they've gone in with their soldiers carrying weapons or guns. They were told, let me be precise. We've discussed the need for them to be incredibly careful.
The health ministry says more than 11,400 Palestinians have been killed since the beginning of the war. The conflict was triggered by the October 7th massacre by Hamas, which Israel says left 1,200 dead. Asked when the war would end, Biden had this to say.
With regard to when is this going to stop? I think it's going to stop when Hamas no longer maintains the capacity to murder and abuse and just do horrific things to the Israelis.
At the State Department, a reporter asked spokesperson Matthew Miller why the president is not calling for a ceasefire, saying polls show many Americans support it.
We don't make our decisions based on polls. The president and the secretary have come to the judgment that a ceasefire at this time would only benefit Hamas.
One expert told VOA that increased U.S. military support for Israel has broad bipartisan support among members of the U.S. Congress. And she said the U.S. could use its leverage over Israel to reduce the number of Palestinian civilians killed as Israel targets leaders of Hamas, which the U.S. has designated a terrorist organization. Elizabeth Shackelford is with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She spoke to VOA via Zoom.
For example, one of the things that we've heard over and over again is that U.S. officials are recommending that Israel use smaller bombs that have a smaller impact on collateral damage. Collateral damage is civilians, includes civilians.
Israel ordered Palestinians to leave four towns in southern Gaza on Thursday, raising concerns of a possible expansion of the war into areas that Palestinians from the north had fled to for safety in recent weeks. Cindy Sane, VOA News, the State Department.
Major humanitarian organizations operating in Gaza say they will not participate in the establishment of any safe zones in Gaza that are set up without the agreement of all the parties to the conflict. The group, including the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, also known as UNRWA, says unilateral safe zones risk harm to civilians. UNRWA spokesperson Julia Tuma tells me that a safe zone must be void of hostilities and must meet basic needs for survival.
The latest, James, is the communications blackout. So right now, Gaza is going through a communications blackout. This is the fourth time that this happens since the beginning of the war. So we've sadly lost contact with the vast majority of our staff once again. We only have very limited connectivity through satellite phones, which is patchy. As a result of this, James, we will not be able tomorrow to pick up the trucks of aid that normally would come from Egypt. We would not be able to do that.
Well, you said that's communication blackout. Is that right?
That's correct.
But how does that prevent you from picking up the trucks?
We need to pick up them right and coordinate on where the trucks are. We need to call our colleagues, so we won't be able to do that.
Juliet, earlier I saw a release here where humanitarian leaders, your position, you said, we will not participate in the establishment of any safe zone in Gaza that is set up without the agreement of all the parties. Is that correct?
Yes. There was a statement that UNRWA, the agency where I work, has endorsed this afternoon. And yes, you're absolutely right. We will not support such proposals.
So who are the other parties that you would like to see included?
Parties to the conflict. All parties to the conflict.
I saw your latest press statement, and you seem to be concerned about a number of issues. The first, you said there is nowhere safe in Gaza. What do you mean?
Exactly that nowhere is safe in Gaza, not the north, not the south, not the middle areas. Nowhere is safe across the Gaza Strip, and no place is safe. So not even hospitals, medical facilities, UN premises and facilities, our own shelters, they've not been spared. And in addition to that, people are trapped. They have nowhere to go. They cannot leave the Gaza Strip.
You have schools running in Gaza, and there's this, you're saying there are allegations that you are teaching different things to the students. Is that correct?
Yeah, thanks. Because there's been a lot of reports over the past couple of weeks with a lot of misinformation and inaccuracies about the content that we teach to children who come to our schools. And what you're referring to is a comment from our Commissioner General that he gave to a press conference in Geneva earlier today, where he emphasized that the agency has zero tolerance to racism and that our schools teach tolerance and that our teachers follow the basics of human rights and they follow the values of the United Nations because they themselves, our teachers, are United Nations civil servants.
So the last we spoke, you talk about your staff. What's the latest on your staff?
So sadly, James, almost every day we have more colleagues killed in the Gaza Strip. Today, we are very sad to confirm that 103 of our colleagues have been killed since the war began in Gaza. The vast majority are teachers in UNRWA schools, and they were killed in different circumstances. The vast majority of them were killed with their families, and we will never be the same without them.
Julia Tuma is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency UNRWA spokesperson. She spoke with us from Amman, Jordan. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera has suspended his foreign trips and those of government officials as part of austerity measures to cushion the impact of the recent 44% devaluation of local currency on the country's economy. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In his televised address to the nation Wednesday night, Chakwera ordered a cut by half on fuel allowances allocated to top government officials, including cabinet ministers. The Reserve Bank of Malawi last week announced the devaluation of a local currency to align it with the US dollar on the black market. The move resulted in instant price hikes of almost all commodities on the market, including fuel and electricity, which increased by over 40%.
I know that this decision has caused a lot of pain, and I know that all of us now have to make big adjustments in spending so that we can prioritize those areas that are most productive and stay the course until our economy becomes productive and profitable again.
Chakwera said he would be the first to make those adjustments.
In making those painful adjustments, I myself have to lead by example. This is why, effective immediately, all of my international trips between now and the end of the fiscal year, beginning with my trip to COP28 at the end of this month, are canceled.
Chakwera also said he was putting a freeze on all public-funded international trips for all public officers at all levels, including those in parastatals or state-owned enterprises, until the end of a financial year in March.
In fact, all cabinet members currently abroad on public-funded trips must return to Malawi with immediate effect.
Analyst Victor Jipofia told a local radio that President Chakwera would have announced measures that would help generate enough foreign exchange for the country rather than those that failed in the past.
How do you generate forex? The country needs to build its industry that is able to export commodities to be able to be having this foreign currency. Nothing like that came out from the president.
Another political analyst, Georgie Piri, said Chakwera's address failed to outline how the government addresses challenges facing people in rural areas where over 80% of Malawians live.
The impact of this devaluation has really affected everyone across the board. Whether he's the president or he is an ordinary Malawian in the rural, and they are not considered in the beneficiaries of the subsidy. What happens with those?
However, the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition says in a statement that if well implemented, the measures that President Chakwera has introduced would likely address the impact of devaluation on the country's economy. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 17. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley's Pulse. Thirty people were killed in South Darfur state following intercommunal fighting between the Habinaya and the Salamat communities over the past 4 days. Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Faith Kasina, UNHCR's regional spokesperson for East, Horn of Africa and the Great Lakes, says armed groups have killed several hundred people in recent days in Darfur.
The reports that we have right now are that more than 800 people have been reportedly killed by armed groups in a location called Ardamata, and this is in West Darfur, an area that has so far been less impacted or affected by the conflict. It's difficult to know the exact numbers, but these are the reports that we are getting, which are definitely very alarming.
Speaking via a messaging application from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Kasina says UNHCR fears that as the conflict continues, many more people will lose their lives in Darfur. She describes the situation as dire. She adds that aside from the killings, UNHCR has had reports of widespread human rights violations, including sexual violence, torture and lootings in parts of Darfur that were previously relatively stable and less impacted by the conflict. Kasina adds that UNHCR is aware that some specific groups of people are being targeted because of their ethnicity. VOA reached out to Brigadier General Nabil Abdallah, spokesperson of the Sudan Armed Forces, for comment, but did not receive a response. Similarly, Yusuf Ezzat, the political advisor for Rapid Support Forces Commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, did not respond to VOA's request for comment. But in a media statement yesterday, the RSF expressed condolences to the families of people killed in Ardmata. The RSF accused the Sudan Armed Forces of deliberately killing civilians while incriminating the RSF. The UNHCR's Kasina says some people who were internally displaced are being secondarily displaced from the areas where they had found refuge.
We are also getting reports that people who were once forced to flee, who are internally displaced, now are finding themselves having to leave the particular site that they had found refuge in because the conflict has reached in one way or the other in the area that they were seeking refuge and protection, and now they have to move to another location.
UNHCR says to end the violence and human rights abuses, the parties to the conflict should ensure an immediate end to the fighting.
We have continued to reiterate that the fighting must stop across Sudan, that people must be allowed to seek safety, whether it's inside Sudan or across borders.
Kasina says the parties to the conflict should also unconditionally respect civilians and avoid innocent people being caught in the crossfire in the conflict. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
The mayor of Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown, Yvonne Akinsoyo, has been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential climate defenders for 2023. She joins the list of global leaders, including Kenyan President William Ruto, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kelly, and the chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Bill Gates. Akinsoyo tells me she is humbled to be recognized for her Transform Freetown agenda, which includes tree planting to reduce the city's carbon footprint.
It's really gratifying when you're passionate about something, you've made a decision to devote all of your, you know, time, effort, skills, everything to that, and then to have other people recognize that you're making an impact. I'm really humbled and grateful and inspired to do more.
What exactly do you do when it comes to protecting the climate? How would you describe the work you do?
What I sought to do through the Transform Freetown agenda, and then more specifically through a climate action plan, has been to reduce our carbon footprint. For example, Freetown, the tree town, where we are planting and growing 1 million trees. And we've done that in a manner where we have unique identifiers for each tree. Each tree has a GPS location that is uploaded into our database. And then the trees are monitored and their growth is tracked by over 1,500 tree growers. And these are community-based organizations, youth who are provided with skills and work. But as far as the tree planting itself goes, it's a multi-benefit intervention because we're planting trees which are economic and with the agreements of communities. We're planting trees on hillsides that have been denuded, where we're stabilizing slopes and preventing landslides and mudslides. We're planting trees along watercourses, protecting our water catchments. So there's so many benefits. And of course, planting trees reduces temperature, which Freetown is really suffering from. I mean, I've just been at function this evening. It is November. Normally at this time of the year, in the part of the city that we're in, which is up on one of the mountains, in Hill Station, it would be cool. We were boiling. Everybody was sweating. And the impact of heat stress is becoming more and more acute in Freetown. So Freetown, the tree town, planting those trees in, both around the city, and this the last batch that we're doing, we're doing 250,000 right now. 30% of those are going to be planted in backyards. So we have tree giveaways. We have trees planted in schools, in hospital compounds, in cemeteries, in addition to the areas I described before. So that's one major accomplishment. And we have an 82% survival rate, which we can track. because we have the digitalization of the process and we have the data. But going beyond the tree planting and growing, we also have worked on renewable energy and clean cooking alternatives. 82% of the cooking fuel used in our city is wood or wood-based. So if we are determined, as we are, to re-green our city, to increase the carbon sink, which is a benefit to everybody, not just for Freetown. But if we want to do that, we need to make sure we're providing alternatives for clean cooking.
Yvonne, thank you very much, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yvonne Akinsoyor is the mayor of Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown, and one of the Time Magazine 100 Most Influential Climate Defenders for 2023. She spoke with us from Freetown. It is now known for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with results of matches played in the Africa leg of the World Cup qualifiers as 16 teams began their quest to qualify for the 2026 World Cup on Thursday. Mohamed Salah scored 4 goals to lead Egypt as the Pharaohs thumped Djibouti 6-0 in Cairo to launch their bid for a place at the expanded 2026 finals. Togo came from behind to draw 1-1 with Sudan. Nigeria are already under pressure in Group C of the 2026 World Cup qualifying after being held to a 1-1 draw by Lesotho at the Godswill Akpabio International Stadium in Uyo. Elsewhere, Burundi were 3-2 victors against Gambia at the Benjamin Mkapa Stadium in Dar es Salaam, while Kenya's return to competitive action saw them suffer a 2-1 defeat to Gabon at the Franceville Stadium. A total of 27 goals were scored across 8 games that were played on Thursday. Staying with football news, Mali recorded an emphatic 5-1 win over Canada to secure their spot in the FIFA Under-17 World Cup knockout phase. They finished runners-up to Spain in Group B, while Canada have been eliminated after failing to pick up a point. Mali will face the runners-up from Group F in the last 16 clash in Surabaya on Tuesday. Another African side, Morocco, beat Indonesia 3-1 to secure top spot in Group A and leave the host facing elimination. The result leaves Indonesia in third spot with 2 points, and they hold only very slim hopes of qualifying as one of the 4 best third-place teams. Staying with football news, the 2023-2024 season of the CAF Africa Schools Football Championship is officially underway as CAF, through its member associations division, prepares to roll out the second edition of the groundbreaking youth football tournament. Building on from the success of its inaugural edition, we saw more than 800,000 boys and girls from over 28,000 schools across 44 countries participating. CAF is once again pulling out all the stops to ensure that the innovative concept as brought forth by the CAF president Patrice Motsepe fulfills its objectives. As in the previous edition, the competition is structured into 3 phases, which is national, zonal and continental, and affords school-going boys and girls a unique opportunity of being exposed to international football. In women's football news, SC Casablanca are through to the CAF Women's Champions League Cote d'Ivoire 2023 finals following a dramatic 3-2 penalty victory over Ampem Dakoa of Ghana after the two sides played out to an exciting 2-2 draw in San Pedro's Laurent Poku Stadium. Both teams were making their debut in Africa's premier women's football club competition as Ghana's Ampem Dakoa and SC Casablanca of Morocco have both had an impressive run in Cote d'Ivoire so far. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, November 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.